Okay, great. Thank you very much, Nandara. It's very lovely to be here with you in Dublin. Real delight to be with you here. And it was very nice doing the mantra. It reminded me very much of being with yourself and Vajrasura in India recently. So that was very good. Okay, so we're going to turn straight away to India, to ancient India. A little story. So there were two friends, and they were called Upatissa and Kolita. And actually, they seem to have been named after the villages that they came from, which were two small villages near the then city of Rajagaha, which is famous for being close to Vulture's Peak, where the Buddha did a lot of teaching. And they've been friends since childhood, but they both had a keen desire for the spiritual life, and they were both on a spiritual quest together. So, as people did in those days, they became spiritual wanderers. They left their home, and they started practicing with a teacher called Sanjaya. But they didn't feel that, you know, Sanjaya had all the answers to what they were seeking. So they kind of made this pact with each other that, you know, they would just keep looking, and whichever one of them found, you know, someone who could take them further down the path, they would let the other one know. So that's what they agreed. So one day, Upatissa is out walking, and he sees this man, another wanderer, and he's like really impressed by the appearance, the sort of demeanour of this person. And he thinks, I think this man is an arahant, or at least well on the way to becoming an arahant, becoming fully enlightened. So he follows him, waits for him to have his meal, and then he approaches him, and he asks him, after they've done their polite exchange, he asks them who he is, what his name is, and who is his teacher. So this person says his name is Asaji. So Asaji was one of the first five disciples of the Buddha. And when asked about when he's asked who his teacher is, he says, it's the blessed one from the Shakya clan. In other words, it's the Buddha, is my teacher. Now, Asaji thinks at this time that, these wandering ascetics, because he sees Upatissa as one of the wandering ascetics, he says quite often they're opposed to the Buddha's teachings. And he thought, I really want to show him how profound the Buddha's teachings are. So he says to him, I've not long gone forth myself. I can't really explain in detail the Buddha's teachings. And Upatissa says, it doesn't matter, just whatever you can tell me, whether it's a little or it's a lot. So he just has four lines, Asaji, that he tells Upatissa, and they go as follows. Of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has told the cause, and also what their cessation is. This is the doctrine of the great recluse. So I'll just repeat that for you. Of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has told the cause, and also what their cessation is. This is the doctrine of the great recluse. So the great recluse being the Buddha. Now, just hearing those first two lines, Upatissa's dharma eye opens. He has a realization. He gets what Asaji is saying. He then goes back, and as soon as his friend Kolita sees him, he sees something has changed in Upatissa, and what's happened? And so Upatissa explains, and then they both go off and find the Buddha and become, in fact, lead disciples of the Buddha and better known under their subsequent names of Sariputra and Mahamoggallana. So there's this story of how Sariputra and Mahamoggallana, who are very famous, sort of in a way head disciples of the Buddha, how they became disciples of the Buddha. So it was through meeting Asaji, and basically what Asaji did was described very succinctly conditionality, or as it's referred to in Indian language, paticca samuppada. And it's got various other terms. It's sometimes referred to as conditioned co-production, sometimes dependent arising, sometimes dependent origination. And those four lines that I've described, you'll find if you go to the sort of the Buddhist world in the East, we can find those four line verse carved in rock or inscribed into sort of things like gold or silver plates or imprinted into mud seals. So they're very, very famous, those four lines. There are another verse which again summarizes conditionality, which is also very famous, and that is, this being that becomes, from the re-arising of this that arises. This not becoming that does not become, from the ceasing of this that ceases. If we want to put that very simply, we could say one way of talking about it is that actions have consequences, or even that one thing leads to another. That might be the very simplest version. So one thing leads to another. Now, when I first came across this teaching, first read those verses, I'm afraid my Dhamma eye didn't open, and my Asaji. In fact, I was rather underwhelmed rather than overwhelmed, should we say, by it. In a way, I think it's sort of deceptively simple. And you get a bit of a flavour of this in the sort of encounter between Ananda at one point and the Buddha. So Ananda being the Buddha's main companion for the latter part of the Buddha's life. And this event apparently takes place amongst the Kurus, in particular a group of people, at Kamasadama, which is quite a nice little ring to it, hasn't it? Kamasadama. So it seems like Ananda's been off reflecting upon conditionality, and he says to the Buddha, after he's had his reflection, "It is wonderful, venerable sir. It is amazing, venerable sir. This dependent origination, in other words, conditionality, is so deep and so deep in implication. Yet to me it seems as clear can be." And then, as often happens in these little exchanges between Ananda and the Buddha, Ananda gets a slight rebuking. Usually, "Say not so, say not so." Although in this particular translation, it's "Not so, Ananda, not so, Ananda. This dependent origination is deep and deep in its implication. It is because of not understanding and not penetrating this Dharma, Ananda, that this generation has become like a tangled skein, like a knotted ball of thread, like matted reeds and rushes, and does not pass beyond the plain of misery, the bad destinations, the netherworld, samsara." So the Buddha is saying that because we don't get conditionality, it's like we just get tangled up, which is, again, something maybe to reflect on, like a knotted ball of thread. And you get this, a similar, in a way, response from the Buddha just after he's gained enlightenment. So he's gained enlightenment and he's absorbing the experience of enlightenment. And the question comes to his mind, should he try and teach the Dharma, what is understood, to other people? And according to the tradition, initially he's reluctant, and he says to himself, "This Dharma discovered by me is deep, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, not within the sphere of reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation is devoted to things which they cling and delight therein. For them it is hard to see conditionality. Nirvana is also hard for them to see. So it's hard to see conditionality, he's saying, because we cling on to things and we get fascinated, obsessed with them. Fortunately, of course, the Buddha did teach, otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here this evening. So, as I alluded to in the title, conditionality is a central teaching of the Buddha. It's one of the, one of the most important teachings, and it finds itself various expressions, such as the Four Noble Truths, the 12 or 24 Nidanas. But although you get these various conceptual formulations, it's really worth remembering that, as the Buddha said in that thing, it's beyond the sphere of reasoning. In other words, the concepts alone don't completely explain it. They're kind of like pointers to a spiritual experience. And just because you, in a way, conceptually understand conditionality doesn't mean you've got it. It goes deeper than that, in a way. So, of course, I'm just talking in concepts, but hopefully what I want to try and do this evening is just point to some facets of conditionality. So basically what I'm going to do in the rest of the talk is just make a number of points, 7 points in fact, for us to reflect on in terms of conditionality. So number one is, don't confuse consequences with actions. Don't confuse consequences with actions. So in some of the explications of conditionality, as I said, it's kind of like one thing leads to another. That's a simple version of them. But some of the things are just the, if you like, the automatic result of what's gone before. But some things are things that we are, if you like, are creating afresh, creating anew. So you see this, for example, in the 12 links or 12 Nidanas. I'm not going to go through all those because that's almost like a whole talk in itself. But just to give you a little excerpt from them. So you've got three links, which are contact, feeling, craving. So contact is just sense impressions registering with me. So as I sit here, I see Jnanadhara, for example. And that any sensation you have has a feeling tone. So that's a pleasant feeling tone. It's Jnanadhara. With a bit worried there, can you see it? So pleasant feeling tone. And then our automatic tendency is to either move towards if it's something pleasant, or move away, push away if it's something unpleasant. So that's our sort of default response. But whereas the first two things are just a result of past action, so you know, the fact that I've got a working body and eyes means I get sense impressions through the eyes, they just arise. The fact that I've got a past relationship with, well, and current, with Jnanadhara, means that because of that, it has a particular feeling tone, which in this case is pleasant. But then how I respond to that, to some degree, is in my control and will have consequences. So, you know, if we take someone who's not in the room, who maybe I have a negative response to, and or an unpleasant feeling tone, I might react with aversion and ill will to that person. And then that is going to have further effects down the line. It's going to create more sort of unpleasant feeling tones. So why am I going into this? Okay, so again, just to give another simple example, because I have a body, if I drop a brick on my foot, it's going to be painful. So that's probably fairly obvious. That's just how things are. It's just a natural response. Similarly, having a body means that sometimes I'll get sick, which means sometimes I'll have unpleasant feeling tones. Similarly, because I've got a mind, sometimes I'll have unpleasant mental feeling tones. Like if somebody's rude to me, I'll have unpleasant ones. If somebody is nice to me, like unusually today when I was coming through the passport control, the lady at the passport control, and I had a little chat because she was interested in my name. And that's never happened to me before, but going through immigration. But obviously, the Irish are very friendly. So anyway, so I had a little chat and she got me to tell her how Paramabandhu was pronounced, because it's in my passport. So that was a pleasant feeling, pleasant mental feeling tone. But particularly when we have unpleasant feeling tones, so like pain from dropping a foot, or if someone's rude to me, or it's very easy to get into recrimination. It's kind of like when unpleasant things happen, when we have unpleasant mental feelings, it's easy to fall into either blaming or into somehow thinking it's a mistake, that this shouldn't be happening. I don't know if you ever had that experience of having an unpleasant mental state and thinking somehow this shouldn't be happening. Why is this happening to me? Sort of thing. And then we just stoke up the aversion or the blame. So what we're doing there is we're, in a sense, mentally at least, complaining about consequences rather than doing something about the actions. Do you see what I mean? So I hope you're with me on this. It's a subtle point, but the reason I make it is because I see it so much of people who are in a sort of negative state, as I say, either thinking it's wrong or falling into blame, rather than a way accepting, well, this is the state that's just arise. I'm not, either I've got physical pain or I've got mental pain. This is just part of being human. This is what will arise. And instead of accepting it just as it's a consequence of something that's happened, getting into, trying to push it away, trying to blame, thinking it's a mistake. So it's, in a sense, like treating consequences as actions rather than seeing it as a consequence that you can't change because it's already here, it's already happened. Yeah. So that's the first point. Don't confuse consequences with actions. Second point is that conditionality can be reciprocal. So again, going back to the 12 links. So, if you read the scriptures, two of the early links are consciousness and what's called nama rupa. Nama rupa is kind of like body and mind more generally. So you've got consciousness, and so if you're following in a progressive, a continuous way, it's on the basis of consciousness, nama rupa arises. But it's also described in the scriptures as like two sheaves of wheat resting against each other, which in other words means they influence each other. So why this is important is, if we put it more simply, we can see there's a relationship, a reciprocal relationship between body and mind. So that's one reciprocal relationship which is maybe a bit easier to understand. So if we've any emotion that we have, it'll have a physical effect on the body. So if I'm feeling anxious, I'll notice that there's tension somewhere in my body. And if I relax my body, if I can pay attention to my body and relax it, then it'll tend to bring down the anxiety. Similarly, there's that thing of, I don't know if you're familiar with this idea of checking your thumbs in meditation. So you're sitting in meditation, you're doing the, you know, what's sometimes called either the posh word is the Dhyana Mudra, the other one is the Cosmic Egg. So you're sitting with that, with your fingers like that and your thumbs together. If you get into a whole craving fantasy or even more particularly a sort of an anger story, then your thumbs start pressing together harder. And if you're just sort of going off into sort of daydreaming, the thumbs tend to drift apart. So I don't know if you've noticed this in your meditation, but it's really good sort of a little sign that you can use to recognise what your mind is doing by just simply paying attention to your thumbs and noticing what your thumbs are doing in meditation. It's really good just keep coming back to your hands and notice what your thumbs are doing. So again, it's this thing of what's going on in your mind affects the body, in this case, the thumbs. But in the same way, also, your body will affect your states of mind. So again, you may have noticed this, of just, you know, the difference in your mind if you're tired or if you're feeling, you know, sort of fit, or if you're feeling, or if you're unwell, versus if you're healthy, you can notice that. I was recently reading a book by Matthew Walker called Why We Sleep, which is very good reading, if slightly alarming. he says that, according to studies, that once we've been awake for more than 16 hours, our brain starts to fail, which is not very many hours if you think about it. And he says that, apparently, again, according to studies, that we need more than 7 hours to maintain cognitive performance. And if we have 10 days sleeping less than 10 hours, our brain will be as dysfunctional as if we'd not slept for 24 hours solidly, you know, had a full 24 hours. And what's even worse, what adds the insult to the injury, is apparently our minds aren't very good at telling how sleep deprived they are. So again, you know, the physical state of our body is going to affect our mind. In this case, you know, if we don't sleep very much, it will affect our mind. So this is the relationship between body and mind. So again, we've got this sort of reciprocal relationship. Similarly, we have a reciprocal relationship between thoughts and emotions. So again, if we're feeling angry, I don't know if you ever notice this, it's very easy to start fueling that. We start rehearsing our reasons to be angry. I don't know if you've ever done that. Andy did that, and you're remembering all the things from the past that they've done. So we can just do the anger story, which just stokes up the feelings or the emotion of anger. Similarly, if we get into disparaging ourselves or other people, so if we get into that sort of story, it'll start to have an effect on our emotions. We might start to feel a bit either irritable or just a bit sort of down and depressed. The Buddha speaking to Ananda, said, when one dwells contemplating gratification in things that can be clung to, craving increases. With craving as a condition, clinging comes to be, and so on, leading up to the whole mass of suffering. So in other words, this is as opposed to rehearsing reasons to be angry, this is sort of, you know, focusing on why I really need this latest gizmo, and you know, it's going to really make a difference to our lives. We recently, someone bought a thing for slicing bread, but it's kind of like a sort of plastic thing that folds in. You sort of lay your bread on it, and it's supposed to make it easier to slice bread. I mean, it doesn't really do it, but you know, as a person who succumbed to buying a mango cutter, I can hardly complain. But again, it can be that thing, you sort of, you know, whether it's, you know, the latest phone or car or something more modest, you start telling yourself this story of how, you know, which of course the advertising feeds up, of how you really need this thing, and then it just fuels your craving. I mean, the good thing about this is it means we can, a bit like with, you know, working with the thumbs to work on the mind, we can work either way. So we can either work with our thoughts to change our emotions, or we can work with our emotions to change our thoughts. So if we are feeling angry, we can work through cultivating metta. Or if we've got the rumination going on, we can practice just letting go of the negative rumination. And I think that's particularly important because often it goes on at a low level. We can have this sometimes you know, sort of negative storyline that can go on in the background that colours our mental landscape, which is really worth just sort of noticing. It can, again, it can often go on a bit subconscious, but it's sort of a bit like a, or can be a bit like a negative radio that if it actually was a radio, you'd definitely change the channel. That's a bit harder to do, just change the channel, but it's definitely something we can work on. The other thing, in a way, about this is also is just to sort of notice the effects on our mind. So, you know, when, again, this comes back to the sort of relationship between consciousness and nama-rupa. So, you know, if we're in a state of wanting, it's really worth to try and notice what the effect of on our consciousness is. So what is that like? What is it like? Usually it have a sort of a tightening effect. And similarly, if our mind gets a bit more concentrated, so we're in meditation and gets a bit more concentrated, really noticing how that makes a difference to our mind. Again, the thing I particularly notice, again, particularly on retreats where I'm doing more meditation, is just that my mind's a bit more flexible and subtle. So it can sort of move around and see things a bit more clearly. So again, just sort of seeing that, we can start to see how conditionality operates, how, you know, the state of our consciousness affects the rest of our mind, and vice versa. Okay, so point three, conditionality is not causality. So what I mean by that is that it's not this thing of one thing leading to another is not inevitable. So, again, coming back to a little section from the Dharana chain, you've got feeling leads to craving and that leads to grasping. So, when I'm sitting at the airport this morning, surveying the pastries that are on offer, I get a pleasant feeling tone, and that leads to craving. Now, in this case, it led to grasping because I went and got my coffee and pastry, but it doesn't have to. You know, we often do run with it, but actually, there is a choice. So these links are not necessary. You know, what's being described is a likely sequence, but it doesn't have to be like that. And so take another example. If we go on retreat, then it's quite likely that our meditation will be more concentrated and that we'll have some pleasant experiences. But it might not be like that. And again, the reason why that's important is because, you know, we can sometimes set up an expectation that I'm going off on a retreat and I'm now going to have a wonderful time. And it doesn't always happen. And if we've got that expectation, it will just cause frustration. So, in a way, the relationship between, you know, one thing leading to another, it's a bit like, you know, like with going on a retreat. You just engage with the retreat and you let it take its course. A bit like, in a way, I was thinking, it's a bit like falling asleep. You can't make yourself fall asleep. You, in a way, you set up the conditions, like you wait till you're feeling tired, you go to bed, hopefully in a sort of quiet place, you might even have some little routines to wind down, but you literally can't make yourself go to sleep. You set up the conditions, and if you're lucky, sleep takes over and you go off to sleep. Well, it's a bit like that in going on retreat. You know, you go on retreat, you engage with the programme, you do the meditation, or even coming here tonight, you know, you sit down, you do the metta-bhavana that we just did, hopefully you feel a bit more metta. But it's not inevitable. You can only set up the conditions. Because you may have come here tonight with a whole other thing that's just happened in your life that then, you know, pops up, and the same when you go on retreat. And it's surprisingly also sometimes you can have quite a long gap between something from the past and it appearing. I mean, again, just to give you a little example, I was last Sunday I went to the flower market in London called Columbia Road Flower Market. So it's basically a street market. And it's just once a week on Sunday morning and very, very crowded. So I was there looking at some plants. And there was a guy kind of next to me at some point who, he had like a little rucksack with a spade in it. So he had this spade handle going right up like that. And at a certain point, he bent over to look at something and knocked me. Fortunately not very hard, and he apologised, you know, straight away, but I was quite short with him, and then I was a bit surprised that, because it wasn't that bad, and I just, you know, sort of said to him, you know, you better be careful with that sort of thing, it's like growling tone. And then I remembered that, oh, quite a few years ago I'd been at Columbia Road Flower Market with a thing, with a little rucksack. Not with a spade, but with a sort of wound-up bag. They're called Columbia Carriers, because you carry your plants from Columbia Road Flower Market on. So I had this thing wrapped up in my, you know, bag. And I did the very same thing to somebody else, where I sort of bent over to look at a plant and you know, hit somebody who was very angry with me. And somewhere, I just, without realising it, I'd somehow carried my, you know, righteous indignation, or not even very righteous, because I had hated the person after all, but anyway, my indignation at, you know, this person getting angry with me, I'd somehow carried that all along, unbeknownst to me, so that when this guy knocks me on the head, I come out quite sharply. So, again, it's sort of strange workings of, in a way, of conditionality that you just can't quite know what's going to, you know, come up, as it were. And the reason why, basically, what the Buddha is describing is he's just drawing attention when, like, for example, when he describes the Four Noble Truths, the 12 Nidhāmas, he's just describing key things that can have an effect, which is why it's the thing is it's not an inevitable thing. There are lots of, you know, well, ultimately, in a way, infinite conditions. There are lots of conditions affecting one another. And the Buddha was just sort of saying, well, look, these are quite important ones. Particularly important ones in terms of how the mind works and how we create suffering. And for that reason, you even get, you know, in the scriptures, you get, for example, in terms of the Nidana chain, you get different versions, and I'll mention a sort of an example of that a bit later on. So yes, so conditionality is not causality. It's not inevitable that one thing will lead to another. It's just a likelihood. But there's, you know, because it's so complex, something different maybe happen, and we need to be okay with that. But also there's a possibility for responding differently, particularly in terms of, you know, something's arisen, we can maybe respond differently rather than going down a habitual route. Okay. Number four. So, one of the things that the founder of our movement, Sangharakshita Bhante, has talked about is conditionality in terms of a cyclic version and a spiral or progressive one. So the progressive one is where you have one positive state that leads to a more positive one, and it sort of gradually gets more and more positive. Whereas the cyclic one is where you have a negative mental state and it tends to just reinforce itself. I mean, arguably, actually, the negative one is also progressive in the sense it gets progressively worse. So, you know, the more we focus on craving or hatred, the more craving and hatred will tend to grow. And another of... So you've got this idea, you know, particularly with this the positive thing of a sort of progressive series of conditions. But it's so that is true, but it doesn't quite always work like that. So Bhante has talked about this thing of path of regular or irregular steps. So the Buddhist scriptures often lay down a path, like the threefold path, so ethics, meditation, wisdom. And it all sounds very nice and straightforward. You practice ethics, you get good at that, and you practice meditation, you get good at that, and then, ba-bum, you get to wisdom. Of course, we want to jump ahead to wisdom as fast as possible and get the goodies. But that's how it's laid out. And, you know, while that is generally true, sometimes we can have wisdom experiences with, you know, very little practice of ethics and meditation. So we can have this almost like sort of jumping ahead. Usually then what happens is we have to come back and do the groundwork and spend more time on our ethical behaviour and our meditation. So all of that is fine, but again, there's just this thing of, in a way, of watching out for our expectations, because, you know, if we set out on the spiritual path, of course we want to make progress, but if we get too caught up on the idea of progress, we can really trip ourselves up because, you know, we can think, I want to be, you know, I'm at point A and I want to be at point Z without actually going through B, C, D, E, F, you know, and so on. And, you know, it's a perfectly understandable thing, you know, we want to make spiritual progress. But it's a really thing to watch out for, because it can creep in all sorts of subtle ways where we want to basically jump ahead of ourselves rather than allowing the natural unfolding of things. And the fact that sometimes we might get a, you know, a sort of sneak preview, as it were, that we can sometimes have like a very deep meditation or something like that, can fuel that, because we think, oh, well, yeah, I had that, so I can do it, but it can be a real source of suffering if we get too attached to that. So we need to watch out for that. Okay, point five is I just want to mention a couple of key links that are really important to keep in mind. So the first one is that craving leads to suffering. So this is the first noble truth. We're bound to have desire for things, want things. That's quite natural. But the more we're attached to it, the more we're attached to the outcome of our desires, the more that we'll create ourselves pain. And quite often we don't recognise that until our craving's been thwarted, until, again, this thing of, for example, you go on a retreat or you're just doing a meditation and you've got a particular expectation. And you maybe don't realise that expectation's there until you're sort of thwarted by it. I mean, I've spent any number of meditation retreats where a certain point, it's usually about, you know, three quarters of the way through. Because up to then I'm thinking, yeah, it's fine, you know, got plenty more to do. And I'm, you know, my conscious level is going, yeah, I'm just being open to experience, you know, whatever arises, it's all good material to work with. And then I suddenly notice at a point, it's usually, say, about three quarters of the way through, where I'm just feeling a bit depressed today. And then I sort of investigate it, and it was like somewhere there was a little bit of me that was holding out for like a really deep meditation or some profound experience of understanding, and it hasn't arisen. And it's like... So again, it's sort of a little example of craving leading to dukkha. So again, we can experience that sometimes when other people let us down, and even when it's a sort of perhaps a reasonable expectation, the fact if we're attached to people behaving in a particular way, then we're going to experience dukkha. So again, it's like, the thing about this is it's like a really good opportunity to see conditionality operating. So any time we get let down because we've had an expectation is a really good opportunity, and we really want to try and seize that opportunity to see conditionality at play, to see this thing of how craving leads to dukkha. And what I, you know, again, coming with this thing of sort of wanting to make spiritual progress, often what I notice in my own mind somewhere, there's, you know, of course, one wants to make spiritual progress, and that's all very good, and to be of benefit for the world, one wants to make spiritual progress, and that's all good. But often I notice there's a little sneaky bit that's about, you know, I want the badge that says I'm a very spiritual, you know, impressive person, or something like that. Which just sort of sneaks in under the radar in the unconscious sort of expectation. So it's really good to sort of try and dig that out if you experience that sort of pain of when an expectation is not met, so that you can, you know, really, you know, pay attention to it again, see how conditionality works, but also get to see yourself more fully. So another sort of key link that's really worth just really having in your mind all the time is the first two of the positive nidanas, which is that dukkha or suffering leads to shraddha or faith. And this comes back to this thing of how we respond to suffering is crucial. So we can either make, you know, when suffering arises, whether it's physical suffering or mental suffering, we can make it worse by trying to push it away or just ruminating on, you know, going into a blame story or a poor me story. Or we can recognise that actually it's part of being human, and we can have a more creative response to it, which will give us confidence in the Dharma. It will give us Shraddha. So we can see that, you know, when we have physical pain, it's simply part of being human, part of, you know, we all suffer pain sometimes. And the more we can respond to that with equanimity and a sense of fellow feeling as well. So, you know, often a good way I find to of is remembering that I'm not the only person who's ever had a toothache or, you know, whatever it is. Similarly, we can recognise that because things are changing all the times, that, you know, we'll get caught out by that. Again, the thing of, you know, we hold on to things because they change. That can then be painful. And the more that we can just see that as just the nature of things, the more we can have confidence in the Dharma, the more we can see conditionality working in our own experience, in our own lives, and have more confidence in the Buddha's path. And, you know, what the usual form is said is that, of the 12 links, is that dukkha or pain and satisfactoriness leads to Shraddha or faith or confidence, and that in turn leads to joy. So the more we can reflect in this creative way when something painful arises, the more we can experience joy. Interestingly, another version of the chains, because I said there's, you know, different versions, has a rather more complex thing. So it says independence on dukkha, Shraddha arises, independence on that arises right attention. Independence on that arises right mindfulness and right comprehension. Dependence on that arises guarding the faculties. Dependence on that guarding morality. Dependence of that absence of regret. And then finally we get to joy. So I think, again, just what this points out in a way is it's, you know, so you get these links listed, but in a way it is a bit of a simplification. So there's quite a bit of work to be done for when pain arises, for it to lead to confidence and then to joy. I mean, in a way, what this alternative set of links is suggesting is that, you know, we really need to pay attention. So we need to get into the minutiae of just what's happened when something painful, when we're experiencing pain, just what is it that's happening from a dharmic perspective. You know, is it because we were trying to hold on to something which is changing? Is it because we're expecting our body to always be healthy and not to fall sick when we know actually that sickness is a part of being human? And then we also need to act skillfully. If we don't act skillfully, if we act skillfully, we then won't have anything to recriminate ourselves with, and that can lead to joy. Okay, so point six is don't underestimate the effect of external conditions. So we can always work with our mind in whatever situation we're in. We can certainly try and do that, and indeed we should try and do that. But we're also going to be very influenced by things around us. Again, just to give a little example from when I was in training at work, I noticed how influenced I was by work values. So at the time I was doing a research job, and the idea came into my head that I could do a higher degree. It's called MD. It's like in the UK, it's like a sort of mini PhD. So I was doing research, and there was certainly this possibility of turning this research into an MD. And whenever I was at work, I thought, oh yeah, that's a really good idea, I must do that. And then whenever I was at home, I'd think, you must be off your rocker. Because I didn't really enjoy doing research. I wasn't, you know, hands-on with people, yes, research, not really interested in. So actually dragging it out and making myself do more, when really what I want to do with the hands-on work, and when I'm not doing that, to be doing Dharma, you know, practice, you know, being involved with the LBC, it seemed crackers, the idea of doing an MD. But yeah, I just noticed each time I'd go to work, I could feel this, oh yeah, that's a really good idea, I should do that sort of thing. And then I'd go away from thinking, oh no, bad idea. Anyway, fortunately, I didn't do it. And it didn't seem to impede my career too much. But it's just that thing of, you know, you move into a particular world and it has an effect. So it's really worth noticing that. I mean, that's, again, I keep mentioning retreats. That's partly why we go on retreats, is because it's a good set of conditions to work with one's mind. It has that positive influence. And, you know, if we're not doing things to put ourselves in conditions that regularly inspire us, we'll tend to lose inspiration from the Dharma. We'll tend to lose our inspiration. So we need to put ourselves in those sort of positive conditions. Someone was pointing out to me the other day that if we're experiencing a negative mental state, we'll often blame, you know, the environment or you know, somebody. Whereas if we're in a positive state, we'll tend to attribute it to ourselves. Which again, I think, is one of those little fallacies, which again doesn't fully recognise the influence of you know, external conditions. So although of course we can work in any condition, it's really worth noticing the effect of our external conditions. And then the final point I wanted to make is about how conditionality can help us to reflect on other key aspects of wisdom, in particularly impermanence and insubstantiality. So when Shariputta, who I mentioned at the beginning as Upatissa, when he heard these first two lines from Asaji, of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has told the cause. It's said that at that point, Shariputra had an insight, an understanding into impermanence, into just the simple fact that everything that arises is going to cease one day. And that truth of impermanence opened his Dharma eye. So in other words, it wasn't just a simple, oh yeah, of course, conceptual understanding, but a more in his guts understanding of how this really is the case. So if we keep noticing how conditions change, how things are changing all the time, it can help us to see more deeply impermanence. So again, the effect of, for example, external conditions, just sort of noticing how we are in one set of conditions and how we are in another set of conditions, how we feel, how we think, how we behave, can point us to impermanence. And it can also point us to insubstantiality. So this is the idea that within all this flux of stuff, there isn't an abiding, unchanging self. It's a bit more like we have a whole busload of them that keep, you know, appearing, different ones. Again, I had a little example of this. Last Saturday, last Wednesday week, I was down in Brixton and being interviewed there at the Brixton Buddhist Centre. And I sort of noticed this whole side of me manifesting, partly, I'm by nature introverted, so my friend Maitre Bandi is more extroverted. If I'm going to be doing an interview, he always says to me, remember, speak. Otherwise the danger is, you know, I'll just give a syllabic answer, you know, to a question. So again, it's just sort of interesting to notice those sort of different sides of ourselves appearing in different situations. So, you know, in this interview I managed to, you know, manifest a more extroverted talkative side of myself. And I think, particularly if we don't get attached to those different things, we just see them as different aspects of ourselves, different things that manifest in different situations, then it can all become a bit freer. So we can just allow whatever is needed in the situation to appear, whilst at the same time realising there's nothing substantial. So I don't need to get attached either to the introverted or the extroverted, you know, version of Paramabandhu, and think that one is really me and that isn't really me, or something like that. It's all just arising stuff without an inherent self. So it's a bit like in the Heart Sutra, for those of you who are familiar with it. So you not only have form is emptiness, but emptiness is form. So things keep arising, appearances keep arising, including appearances of ourselves. Our different selves keep arising in different situations. So, I've spoken of seven areas to do with conditionality. No doubt one could include many more, but that seems enough to be going on with. I'm getting a nod from Jnanadhara. So I'll just remind you what those were. So, one, don't confuse consequences with actions. Two, conditionality can be reciprocal. Three, conditionality is not causality. Four, progressive conditionality is at least somewhat progressive. Five, suggested two links to always remember. So craving leads to suffering, and suffering can lead to faith. Six, don't underestimate the effects of external conditions. And seven, reflect on impermanence and insubstantiality. So these are sort of seven areas that we can reflect on. And all of that needs to, in a way, to be held within metta. So it's very good that we're doing the metta bhavana to start with. We could see another sort of reciprocal relationship in terms of conditionality is between metta and actual seeing of conditionality. In a way, if our minds aren't filled with metta, it's very hard to really deeply see the workings of conditionality. You know, one of my favourite little phrases from one of my psychotherapy teachers was that anger makes you stupid. In other words, when you're angry, you just can't see clearly. Whereas when we have metta, you can see more clearly and you're more likely to be able to see conditionality. And the more we can do that, we'll see it unfolding more and more deeply. As the Buddha said on his awakening, "This Dharma discovered by me is deep, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, not within the sphere of reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise." So if we keep on attending to conditionality, and in a way this is what these 7 points are, just sort of different ways of noticing, attending to conditionality, then we have a chance of experiencing a Dharma that is peaceful and sublime.